KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for tuning in today to the show. Today I'm excited to have a return guest on the show, Professor Mark Lemley from Stanford Law School and of counsel at Kecker and Van Nest in San Francisco, has graciously agreed to take the time to come back on Hearsay Culture and continue our discussion of sorts in the area of patents in particular. Professor Lemley was on the show about a year ago, roughly, literally on the day of, or perhaps the day after the KSR case was decided, a really landmark case in patent law that we're going to be following up on. But today we're going to have a wide-ranging discussion, really taking a look at some of the issues that the courts and indeed the patent bar and the business world are facing right now in the world of patent law in particular. And so we're going to be focusing on a few topics. So we're going to start off with a discussion of the case Ex Parte Bilski, which is a case that's reconsidering the scope of patentable subject matter, focusing on business method patents, which are an area of high controversy, as well as mental methods. And really, from a much broader perspective, taking a look at Section 101, which Mark will discuss in more detail, to determine ultimately what we're going to call patentable subject matter. The Bilski case has quite a few amicus briefs that have been filed by a variety of entities and individuals and law professors. Professor Lemley, along with Mike Risch and Professor Wagner, co-authored an amicus brief that was filed, along with many other individuals and groups. And so we're going to look through the Bilski case and talk about that and talk about the amicus brief that Professor Lemley filed and see where that case is going. As well, we'll do a update of KSR and get into a discussion of more recent research and really just the scope of patent reform as it exists today, including some research that's being done on patentability and innovation. Professor Lemley is really, besides being a prolific scholar, is someone who really has quite a bit of knowledge in intellectual property law generally. And so the knowledge that he brings to the table, along with his experience dealing with these cases directly, is quite valuable. His resume is extensive. Suffice to say, he's a prolific author of law review articles as well as books, as well as an active litigator in the patent bar. His reputation far precedes this show, and so I'm delighted to have Professor Lemley back on the show. Also, as I said last time, and note for purposes of disclosure, I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School, which falls under the broad jurisdiction of the Law Science and Technology program at Stanford. So whereas I was a employee full-time at Stanford Law School last year, I'm now a non-resident fellow, but I am affiliated with Stanford, where Professor Lemley runs the Law, Science, and Technology program. So, Mark, I think I've done my job properly. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you.
Let's start right off really with perhaps a broad take, kind of a very broad question. So over the last year, describe for me the scope of you know, in general terms, we'll get into specifics, the scope of the patent world and some of the issues that have arisen in the past year.
Well, I think what's going on really not just over the past year, but in the last decade, is a patent system that has found itself in crisis in a number of ways, in part because of a flood of patents. There were far more patents issued in the United States than ever before in history, and in part because of litigation practices that have led to some abuses in the enforcement of those patents. And both the courts and Congress have been actively working on efforts to try to solve these problems, to try to limit the abuses of the system without undermining the benefits that patents provide to inventors.
Mm-hmm. And to contextualize the discussion, when we're talking about patentability, for those people that aren't familiar, we can start with the very basics. When we talk about patentable subject matter and the scope of patents, what kind of situations, what kind of inventions are we referring to?
Well, the statute is quite broad. So the Patent Act says any one who invents a new and useful process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter can get a patent on it. And Congress, when it wrote that statute in 1952, said, we intend patentability to extend to anything under the sun made by mankind. So the question is whether there are really any limits on the kinds of things that are potentially eligible for patent protection.
The scope of patent, as we're going to discuss shortly, is hotly debated, and that's where we get into Bilski. But to frame patent law within the broader scope of intellectual property, where does it fall, and how does it overlap or not overlap with copyright, trademark, and trade secret?
Traditionally, the way we've thought about it, and I think the way the framers of the Constitution thought about it, was that patents applied to the so-called useful arts, to technological inventions, while copyrights protected writings, works of art, creative as opposed to inventive activities. But over the last several decades, that line has blurred almost to the point of non-recognizability. There are a bunch of reasons for that, but among them are the sort of merging of form and function in utilitarian products. The design of a car or a fan or a lamp can incorporate both artistic elements and inventive elements, and it's hard to separate those out. But the most significant thing that I think has blurred the line between technological and non-technological creativity is computer software and digital content, because it's really quite difficult to separate out the literary act of writing computer code from the technological development of what is effectively a machine.
And we're going to talk about software code in particular, as well as we discuss Bilski and get into some of the other areas. But to frame the discussion, where, in terms of its prevalence in business and in practice, where does patent law fall? In other words, how often, as a general matter, I'm not looking for specific numbers, but how important, to use a very vague term, are patents to the operation of the intellectual property scheme that we have today?
Well, I think they're critical. It's hard to compare patents and copyrights or trademarks in terms of the sort of numbers of rights owned, in part because there is no measure of the number of copyrights that are owned. The legal standards are just different. But it is certainly fair to say that the patent system is integral to virtually every kind of industry that exists in the United States today. There are 450,000 patent applications filed every year in the United States, and there are something on the order of 2 million United States patents in force at any one time. And obtaining those patents, licensing those patents, worrying about someone else's patents are activities that increasingly preoccupy business leaders at the highest levels of our most innovative companies.
A few more contextual questions, and we can discuss Bilski. I found this in my own teaching already, as well as talking to people. There's a pretty, I think, general level of, I'd say, misunderstanding or perhaps confusion among people that encounter intellectual property in one form or another, but don't delve into it heavily, i.e., I'm not speaking of intellectual property lawyers or even of people that have been heavily involved in getting a patent issued or getting a copyright. And so the question I have really is, again, for overview purposes, we know the utilitarian theory as the basis for U.S. intellectual property law. Perhaps you could describe generally what are the underlying theoretical bases for intellectual property broadly in the United States, including the utilitarian theory.
Sure. The predominant reason we grant intellectual property protection, and certainly the reason we grant patent protection, is as a sort of government policy to support innovation. The worry is that it costs time and money to innovate, and once you innovate, it's often fairly cheap to copy someone else's idea. And whenever you've got a situation where it's very expensive to be the first person to come up with the idea, but it's quite cheap to imitate that idea afterwards, there's a worry that we've got a public goods problem. Everybody wants to be an imitator, nobody wants to be an innovator, and we won't get enough invention. The patent system is designed to solve that problem by giving some limited legal rights over inventions to the people who come up with them. There are, you know, good reasons to believe that how much incentive we need differs from invention to invention, and certainly differs from industry to industry. And of course, there are costs to the government granting monopolies, excluding particular technologies from competition. Pharmaceuticals, for example, cost a lot more while they're under patent than they do once the patent expires. And so the government has tried to calibrate this regulatory incentive it creates with the patent system by aiming for encouragement of invention, but not absolute legal rights over the resulting invention.
Last background question before we get into Bilski. Again, I don't think people have a generally good idea about how one gets a patent. So broadly, and it'll help help us understand our discussion of Bilski. How does an entity go about getting a patent in broad strokes?
Right. So patent is granted by the United States Patent and Trademark Office. If you think you've come up with a new invention, you file a patent application with the PTO. In which you describe your invention and then you write a legal definition of what it is that you think you own, that you've done, that no one else has done before. That application is reviewed by the PTO. The patent examiners are technically trained individuals in the fields in which the applications are filed, but they're also subject to enormous time constraints. And so they give the application a review. They look around to see if the same invention has been made by someone else before, or if, even if the same invention hasn't been made, something else has been done so similar that the invention you've applied for would be obvious. If they don't find that invalidating prior art, as we call it, in a relatively cursory search, then they're likely to issue a patent. And the data that is based on research I've done suggests the examiners issue patents in approximately 75 to 78% of the cases in which they're applied for.
Is that a surprisingly high number to you?
It's pretty high. I think it is hard to know whether it's too high without some evidence that we can't get, which is how many bad applications are there out there. But it's right to say that the number is somewhat higher than it is in other countries' patent systems, and that there are various structural incentives in the patent office that incline examiners to grant rather than deny patents in doubtful cases, with the result that I think virtually everyone would agree that there are some bad patents out there. There are patents issued by the PTO that should not, in fact, have been issued.
And I think that gets us to Bilski, and I think we may come back to that number briefly later in the show. Perhaps we can chat a few minutes about the Peer to Patent Project and whether that ultimately will have any impact on this analysis. Let's get into Bilski. So, again, for people that are totally unfamiliar with the Bilski case, perhaps this is almost like a law school question that I would ask my students, but briefly, what are the facts of Bilski and ultimately what's the issue that the federal court is addressing?
Well, the issue is whether the broad patentable subject matter that we talked about earlier, any new and useful process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter, requires that the invention that the applicant is seeking patent protection for be technological in some way. So in Bilski and in some related cases, the applicant was seeking a patent on a business method, a method of, in this case, hedging financial risks in the derivatives markets. And that method could be and often would be implemented in a computer program, but it didn't have to be. The application itself simply required the use of a particular method of hedging financial risks. So it is something that could conceivably have been done by individual financial analysts working with a pencil and paper or even working in their heads.
And again, to be clear, and I think you defined it there a little bit, but when we're talking about a business method, we're talking about something that is, or correct me if I'm going too far, relatively new development in terms of the kinds of things that we think about as being patentable.
Yes, that's right. The law traditionally applied to inventions in what you might call the technological arts. And it wasn't until 1998 in the State Street Bank case that the Court of Appeals that hears all patent cases decided that patents could apply to business methods as well as more traditional technological inventions.
Now, the case also refers to what are called mental methods. Now, what exactly are those?
Well, the issue there has to do with whether someone has invented a new process if the process can be conducted in whole or in part by thinking about something. Have I come up with a new process if I've come up with a new way of solving a problem in my head, or is there some requirement in the patent statute that the invention involved physical transformation of something?
So we're getting into as you mentioned, referencing, the basic point, anything made by man, roughly. We're getting pretty far into a quite broad definition of a patentable subject matter. And I guess I'll ask you, basically the negative question here. What's wrong with issuing business method patents and what we're referring to as mental methods?
Right. Well, so the answer to me, I think, is nothing. This is a hard question for a lot of people for a couple of reasons. One is that we haven't traditionally granted patents in these areas, and so it's new. People haven't in the past thought when developing new business ideas about patent protection, about the possibility of infringing someone else's patent. So it's a changed circumstance. It's also the case, though, that we've seen a lot of examples of bad patents in the software and business method world, and that may be a function either of the way the patent office looks at and examines those patents, or also a function of the uncertainty in scope that surrounds the definition of a business idea. That it's much clearer, much easier to know whether your chemical is the same as the patentee's chemical than it is to know whether your business approach, your business plan, is the same as the patentee's business plan.
We're going to explore this a bit. It's an interesting area. Now, you co-authored an amicus brief in the Bilski case, and actually the Patent Leo blog, which I've referenced pretty much every time I've discussed patent law with a guest, has an excellent kind of overview going through the various briefs that were filed. Let's discuss your brief a bit and explore some of the arguments. So what would you say is the core of your argument regarding Bilski?
We argue that there is not and should not be in the law a requirement of physical transformation or a physical machine in order for an invention to be patentable. And we basically make two points. One is that even if there are a bunch of bad patents out there, a bunch of patent applications that shouldn't have issued as patents in these fields, it's also the case that there are new inventions. There are really new and important steps that are being taken in the financial services market, in the electronic commerce market, in areas that are not traditional areas of technology, but which nonetheless deserve protection. And then the second prong of the argument that we make is that it's virtually impossible for the courts to draw a line between the physical and the non-physical, or the technological and the non-technological, in a world of computers. And indeed, over the last 15 years, leading up to the State Street decision in 1998, courts tried to do exactly that. And the result was what Julie Cohen and I have called the doctrine of the magic words. It wasn't that you couldn't patent a mental idea, a software invention, a mathematical algorithm. It's that you had to pretend you were patenting something a little different than what you had actually invented. And that proved unworkable, and it led to a number of undesirable consequences. It's one of the reasons we abandoned this idea that there's got to be some sort of physical invention or physical machine that is patentable in the State Street case in 1998.
One of the arguments you make in your amicus brief, and again, I'm simplifying it certainly, and so I certainly encourage you to flesh out the nuances, or if I'm oversimplifying it, to correct me. But one of the basic arguments you make is that to draw an outright ban on business method patents broadly, you call in your brief on page two, you refer to arbitrary limits. You say arbitrary limits on the patentability of particular types of inventions can interfere with the purposes of the patent system. And so I guess I want to ask you, what is arbitrary in your view about drawing that line? How do you see that as arbitrary, and what ultimately is the outcome if it is?
Sure. Let me start by giving you an example. I mean, suppose you wanted to say, we don't patent software. A lot of people want to say that. Europe still does at least pretend to say it, and the United States once said it. And so one possible outcome of the Bilski case is a rule that says computer software is not a patentable invention. Physical changes, physical technologies, machines, those are the kinds of things that are patentable inventions. If you said that, what do you say to the inventor of the hybrid car engine? It seems to me a very clever, useful invention. I drive a Prius. I'm very happy with it. But that invention is at least in part, and maybe mostly in part, a computer program.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The hybrid engine is not that different than either existing batteries or existing internal combustion engines. What's different about it is the precise controlling of when the engine turns on and off and when it switches over to battery control. And, of course, that's controlled by a computer.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is going to become, is that a computer program and so not patentable, or is it a machine and so it is patentable? And if it's a machine because it's got these physical components too, does it matter that the really inventive pieces, the things that really distinguish it from what came before in the world, are embodied not in the physical parts but in the software? And these are metaphysical questions in some sense, but they're questions courts had to struggle with throughout the 1980s and 1990s when they tried to draw this line between physical hardware, which was patentable, and computer software, which was a mathematical algorithm and so was unpatentable.
And we'll get into this a bit as we think about it or speak about what the data suggests, at least what we can tell about patents. and the incentives to innovate. But you do make another point in the brief, which we can discuss now, and we'll take a short break in a moment. But you refer to the fact that we already have ultimately on the books laws to prevent the kinds of harms that other amici in fact argue, and we'll talk about those in a moment. What tools do you see already exist in the law to allow this, with the follow-up question being, if in fact the Patent and Trademark Office, as you refer to, has certain structural issues that it has to deal with respect to staffing, etc., are we in fact, by virtue of your argument, basically saying that the courts should weed this out? And if so, then I guess the follow-up question is, and you mentioned, this probably is the role of Congress. What's your reaction to those questions and statements?
Yeah, so the answer, Rob Merges once famously said of software patents, there are three kinds of people in the world. There are people who think all patents are bad, just want to abolish the patent system. There are people who think software patents are bad, and we should get rid of this category of software patents. And then there are people who think bad software patents are bad. And I'm with Rob Merges in that last category. There are useful inventions in software. There are useful inventions in business methods that deserve patent protection. There are also patents that shouldn't have been issued, or patents that lawfully issued with narrow scope that the applicants are trying to imbue with broad scope. And those are fact-specific problems with the system. Mm-hmm. And I think those fact-specific problems with the system ought to be solved not by wiping out all patents of this particular class, but by targeting the bad patents. And we've got a number of ways in which we can do that. One way we could do it is we could try to improve the patent office examination process. We could try to make sure that the bad patents don't get through the system. It's notable in that regard that the patent office imposes a second pair of eyes review for business method patents. That is, it subjects them to more scrutiny than it does any other kind of patents. And as a result, the likelihood of getting a patent application through the patent office, which I said was on average 75%, is much, much less for business method patents. It was 4% for applications filed in 2001. So the PTO actually does a pretty good job by working harder on business method patents of weeding out bad ones and weeding out indeed quite a few applications that it's decided shouldn't have issued. Yeah. But the patent office, because it gets 450,000 applications a year, is never going to solve that problem. It's never going to get rid of all the bad patents. Courts, therefore, I think have a responsibility and have the tools to identify the obvious inventions, the ones that shouldn't have been issued, and weed those out in court, to limit the scope of the patents that are asserted to what it is that the patentee actually invented, and also to limit the remedies that patentees can get to make sure that business method patents or any other kind of patents don't end up interfering with legitimate commerce.
You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU FM Stanford, in discussion with Professor Mark Lemley of Stanford Law School. As all of you who listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, whether on KZSU or through podcasts, know, KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford Law School that relies on donations from listeners like you in order to continue its diverse programming. You do have options on making a donation. A couple of ways to do this: you can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless of what you do, I do hope you continue to keep listening to KZSU. So here on Hearsay Culture, we're chatting with Professor Mark Lemley of Stanford Law School. Mark, I want to read a paragraph you have again in your amicus brief on page 16, which I found interesting and explore a little bit. You have a paragraph that says, "The current law thus strikes the correct balance between preventing the patenting of subject matter that, because of its abstract nature, properly belongs in the commons upon which future innovations can be built, quote, free to all men and reserved exclusively to none, unquote, and subject matter that builds upon that commons to create an invention of concrete and tangible utility. One of the big criticisms, one of the big concerns with intellectual property rights, as you know, is the issue of the impact on the commons or on the public domain. What's your view of, and clearly I sense it, but perhaps you can expand on it, your view of the impact of these types of patents on the commons or on the public domain?
Well, I think if the patent system works properly, it's going to provide protection only for a limited period of time and only to inventions that not only weren't in the public domain, but weren't even easily identified from the public domain, that is, weren't obvious to somebody with a little bit of work based on what was in the public domain. So the goal of the system is to ultimately enrich the public domain by making sure that we don't withdraw from the public things that they already had in their possession or could have gotten with minimal effort. And then at the end of 20 years to take the new inventions that we've encouraged and put those in the public domain too.
The Patent Leo website, which I said is an enormous resource, actually has all of the amicus briefs that are filed in the case, including yours, available for download. And so certainly anyone that's interested in looking at these briefs can find them there. In looking through some of the briefs, I noted, I mean, as I mentioned at the beginning, there's a wide variety of entities and individuals who filed amicus briefs here. I mean, ranging from law professors to companies like American Express and Accenture, IBM, Dell, Microsoft. I mean, it's obviously an incredibly important area to the business world. But also we saw amicus briefs filed from nonprofit and advocacy organizations like the ACLU, the EFF, an organization called End Software Patents. I think it's pretty clear where they come down. What's your sense in terms of the number of briefs here, and indeed the positions? Do you have any theories or views as to the range of positions taken by different organizations, and where if there's any trends or patterns that you may have picked up on where those where they're falling with respect to this issue?
Well, no, I think actually what you can see as a general pattern is that there is no general pattern.
Mm-hmm.
You've got law professors saying subject matter should be expansive. You've got law professors saying subject matter should be limited. You've got computer companies saying subject matter should be expansive. You've got computer companies saying subject matter should be limited. You've got financial services companies saying subject matter should be expansive. You've got financial services companies saying subject matter should be limited. So what's notable, I think, is that unlike many of the issues we've seen in patent law in the last 10 years, this one has not created an obvious industry split with one group of people monolithic on one side and a different industry monolithic on the other side. Instead, what it's done is it's divided people within industries and people within academia themselves. And I think that's an indication of the difficult line drawing problems that the court is going to have if it tries to limit patentable subject matter.
It is notable because certainly on the surface it's hard to see or at least it's not readily apparent to understand why companies like American Express and Accenture would take a position more in line with your position or your brief's position, whereas a company like IBM and Dell and Microsoft take a more narrow view. And I guess in looking at these issues and looking at how they've wound through the courts, is there any sense, and this is really, I'll preface this by saying that this is the crystal ball question, which is always unfair, especially for a litigator or a former litigator to be asking someone to predict the outcome of litigation. It's almost criminal. But I'll ask for your sense anyway. What do you see – Do you have a sense of what you think the outcome is going to be, or how the court might come down in this case, given the breadth and really remarkable breadth of briefs that were filed by the amici in this case?
So it is always difficult to predict. I am not, frankly, terribly optimistic that the court will stick with its broad subject matter rule that it established in the State Street Bank case. I think there are a lot of indications that that the court is looking to cut back on the scope of patentable subject matter. One indication is the United States Supreme Court decision or non-decision in the LabCorp case in 2006. The U.S. Supreme Court has been reining in the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit on patent cases in the last few years. And while it ultimately didn't decide the patentable subject matter question in LabCorp on a procedural ground, three of the justices in dissent would have ignored the procedural ground in order to write an opinion that narrowly circumscribed the scope of patentable subject matter. And I think for the Federal Circuit, the writing was on the wall at that point. And so in two decisions in 2007, Comiskey and Nuchin, the Federal Circuit went out of its way to impose limits on patentable subject matter, one a business method case, the other a software case involving software programs not on a physical disk but transmitted over the Internet. And in both cases, the court started really for the first time in 15 years to write opinions that suggested there were some teeth to the patentable subject matter requirement. And my guess is that that is the way that Bilski will ultimately go. What teeth the court puts in that requirement, how it defines that limit, is of course going to be critically important, and there I'm much more hesitant to predict, in part because, as our brief suggests, I don't think there is a good answer to that question.
Fair enough, and I won't ask you an even more unfair question, which could be when do you expect a decision. Suffice to say that at some point we'll have a decision from the Federal Circuit, and we'll be able to go from there. Let's turn for a moment to KSR. We discussed KSR last year, and perhaps again for the benefit of listeners who aren't familiar, what ultimately was the holding of KSR, and then have you noticed any? What have you noticed as the impact thus far of the KSR decision?
KSR is the Supreme Court case in 2007 that dealt with the obviousness requirement for patentability. This is the most important of the requirements that a patentee has to overcome in order to get a patent. You've got to demonstrate not only that you've done something new that no one has done before, but that what you've done is sufficiently different, sufficiently innovative, that the ordinary scientist in the field wouldn't have been able to do it without extraordinary effort. The problem with the obviousness test is the well-known problem of hindsight bias. If you come up with an invention, especially if it's an invention that can be described pretty simply, it's quite easy for people after the fact to say, well, yeah, of course you could have done that. And to combat the hindsight bias, the Federal Circuit had for 20 years or so imposed a pretty restrictive set of rules on what evidence could prove that an invention was obvious. The KSR case swept away those rules and said, we've got to ask the question on a case-specific and industry-specific basis. What do the scientists in this particular field know? What would they be able to figure out? How inventive are they? And on the basis of those questions, how likely is it that we would have gotten this invention even if the patentee hadn't come up with it?
And the
what's the fallout from KSR? Well, in some sense, it's too soon to tell, but I think it seems reasonably clear that the direction of movement in the obviousness cases is against the patentee. Certainly that's been true in the Patent Office, where the Patent Office Board of Appeals has proven much more willing to reject applications on the basis of obviousness than it was before KSR. But I think it's ultimately going to prove to be true in the courts as well, because the rigid rules that we had before KSR did leave at least some patentees in the position of being able to get away with patenting something which most of the people in the field would have told you that they could have figured out how to do. That's no longer true.
And indeed, you know, being a case that was decided last year, certainly it would be difficult to see those trends at this point. But it's interesting that already we can see some impact. I think before we actually talk about some of the recent research that's being done and some of the work that you're doing as well, dealing with the impact of patents on innovation, I do want to discuss for a couple of minutes the Peer to Patent Project, the project that was launched. I guess roughly a year ago, give or take, that enlists really the public's help in going through issues ultimately of novelty and non-obviousness for the benefit of the patent examiners. What's your view of the Peer to Patent Project, and you could describe in a little more detail than I have, and what do you think is the likely benefit or not of the project? What kind of impact do you think it'll have?
I think it's a good idea, and the real question is, can it scale? So right now there's a pilot project in which some applicants have agreed to have their applications reviewed by what's in effect outside peer review. And I think the project on that pilot basis seems to be working pretty well. The question is whether there's enough community interest in reviewing patent applications in enough different areas to sustain the project if you apply it to all 450,000 applications that are filed every year. And that's a tougher question. I think the Peer-to-Patent Project is one example of a broader effort to try to get people with knowledge and interest in particular inventions to disclose information to the Patent Office. The problem the Patent Office has is it has very limited time in which it can find the relevant prior art and analyze that prior art.
Mm-hmm. Is it ultimate? Go ahead.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Go. Please continue.
Okay. If we can find a way to harness information in the possession of private parties and get that information before the patent office or before the courts, we're going to get a much better determination of validity. One way to harness that information is peer-to-patent. Ask outside experts voluntarily to come in and bring us information. Another way to harness that information is post-grant opposition. Ask competitors effectively to come in and say, these patents are ones that worry us. These patents are ones that we think were wrongly issued. And there's a bill pending in Congress right now that would do precisely that. A third way to harness private information would be some sort of gold-plated patent system of the kind Doug Lichtman and I have proposed, in which applicants could affirmatively opt into more aggressive scrutiny by the patent office in exchange for a stronger set of patent rights, a stronger presumption of validity. Mm-hmm. And that would allow the applicants themselves to signal to the PTO, these are the applications that are really important to us, you should pay more attention to them.
The project itself was certainly launched with some fanfare, and the website itself included numerous luminaries extolling its virtues. I noted in taking a look at the site earlier today that right now there were 15 applications up on the site from what I could tell. Do you have any sense of, and you mentioned in terms of scaling, Do you have any sense of the trends? I mean, clearly, a large company with multiple patents may be willing to throw one of their patents up there and take the risk that it might be invalidated. On the other hand, a smaller company might arguably not have that, that incentive. On the other hand, the arguments made on a website that it actually improves your process by getting all of that information out there and getting the prior art or lack thereof identified. Do you have a sense, in terms of the, kind of industries or kind of individuals that that are interested at this point in putting their application up for public scrutiny?
I think it has primarily been some large technology companies who've been willing to do it. I think it's right to say that a patent that has been looked at by peers, that has had the most relevant prior art submitted to the examiner, is at the end of the day a stronger patent. But I understand why some applicants would worry that they'll wrongly get their application rejected. And I also understand, though I'm less sympathetic to applicants who decide that they're better off trying to sneak a bad patent through the system than having that more serious scrutiny. If we were to scale the peer-to-patent project into a real examination aid, I think one of the things we would need to do is turn it from a voluntary into a mandatory system. That is, make sure there are provisions in the law that allow the submission of third-party information and allow examiners to consider that information. And the patent reform bill in Congress right now would do that, among other things.
What's your sense of that bill's likelihood of becoming law in its current form?
Declining rapidly is the short answer to that question. This has been a four-year project. It has, a year ago, seemed extraordinarily close to passage. It has passed the House. It has passed out of the subcommittee and the full committee in the Senate, and it's just awaiting action on the Senate floor. But it's been awaiting action on the Senate floor for almost a year, and people inside the Beltway keep saying things like, oh, well, it's coming up next month, and then a month passes, and then it's coming up next month, and then a month passes. And that leads me to believe that momentum is stalled, and as we move into an election year, I think the odds of seeing congressional patent reform are diminishing.
At this point, who are its prime sponsors or the people, from what you can tell, doing a heavy lifting?
One of the reasons to believe, you know, earlier on that the bill was going to pass was that it has had bipartisan support. It's had support from the Democratic chair and the ranking Republican member of the Judiciary Committees in both the House and the Senate. They're all co-sponsors of the bill. And it's not been a political issue. It has proven to be an industry-specific issue that has divided the information technology folks on the one hand from the biomedical industry on the other, with the information technology industries generally in support of patent reform designed to deal with litigation abuse, and the biomedical industry opposed to virtually all of the controversial reform issues.
We're speaking with Professor Mark Lemley from Stanford Law School. Mark, we have about 5 minutes left, which, of course, is more than enough time to discuss the broad question of patent rights and their connection to innovation. So we'll have a very truncated discussion. But yeah, as you know, there's a book coming out, or perhaps it's out, by James Besson and Michael Murr, entitled Patent Failure. And in their book, which I have to say I have not yet read, but my understanding is that they really take a close look at the patent system and ultimately conclude that the patent system is not meeting that goal. What's your sense at this point of without reference to that particular book, because like I said, I haven't read it, and I don't want to discuss its details for that reason. But what's your sense broadly of that critique? In your view, is the patent system meeting broadly, again putting aside the specifics of business method patents in particular, but broadly, is it meeting that goal?
Well, I think think the answer to that is complex because I suspect that the answer differs depending on the industry you're in. And the Besson and Moyer book, in fact, offers some pretty striking evidence of that. So they divide the evidence on the costs and benefits of the patent system into the chemical and pharmaceutical industries on the one hand and everybody else on the other hand. And what their evidence purports to show is that the patent system's benefits far exceed its costs in the chemical and pharmaceutical industries, but that over the last 20 years, the costs of the system to everyone else have far exceeded their benefits. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem that that creates for policymakers and for courts is the difficulty of applying a unitary patent system to industries which have such fundamentally different characteristics.
Let's and we're recording on April 22nd, so just I would be remiss in not discussing something that we discussed very briefly before we came to record. Today's decision in the FTC Rambis case. What is that decision, and quickly, what do you see as its impact?
The D.C. Circuit today ruled in the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission case against Rambis. The issue here is standard-setting organizations which set technological protocols that everybody in the industry then adheres to. And the problem of capture of those standard-setting organizations by patent owners. In the Rambis case, the evidence appears to suggest that Rambis went to the meetings of a standard-setting organization, participated in the design of that organization's protocol, and didn't tell people that it was, in fact, writing patent applications to cover the standards that the group adopted. And indeed, even after it left the group, the evidence suggests that Rambis continued to collect evidence about the participation and the decisions of the standard setting organization so that it could write its patent applications to cover what the group was doing. The Federal Trade Commission held that that violated the antitrust laws, that Rambis had monopolized the industry by capturing an industry standard with its patented technology. The D.C. Circuit just today reversed that decision, concluding not that Rambis had behaved well necessarily, but that the commission couldn't prove that that Rambis had monopolized the market because of its failure to disclose patents. That is, the commission couldn't prove that if Rambis had told the world about its patents, the industry would have gone somewhere else. The broader issue I think that this raises is connected to the significant problem of litigation abuse in the patent system. There are a lot of incentives for applicants to get a bad patent or to get a good patent that covers one thing but then argue that it covers something else, and to try then to capture value from a successful technology that is out of proportion to what it is that the patentee actually contributed. I think Rambis is an example of that. Rambis charges 0.75% of sales as royalty for its patents that don't cover an industry standard, and 3.75% for patents that do cover an industry standard. And that is an indication of the additional value that Rambis could capture, not because its technology was any better, but just because it happened to write a patent that covered what the industry standard converged on.
We've covered a wide range of information here. Obviously, we're out of time, but I certainly want to ask you about the book you have coming out, co-authored with Dan Burke. The title and broadly, what are you looking to achieve with the book?
So Dan and I have a book coming out that's called Bend or Break: How the Patent System Found Itself in Crisis and How Industry Tailoring Can Save It. And it's directed at a lot of the things we've been talking about today. It's directed at figuring out a way for the patent system to stay whole, to stay intact, while dealing with the fact that different industries have enormously different takes on the patent system, that some seem to benefit from the system while others seem to be hurt by it, as evidenced by the fights over patent reform, by the Bessemer book, and even by the Bilski issues. And basically what Dan and I argue is that rather than trying to legislate different patent systems for each industry, which we think would be a nightmare, what we need to do is for the courts to create some rules sufficiently flexible that they allow individual cases to take account of the needs of different industries. We've seen some movement in that direction. I think the KSR decision is a move in that direction, because of its focus on what individual scientists in each different field would think. I think the eBay case, which says courts have the discretion to decide whether or not to grant injunctions once they find patent infringement, is another helpful example. And that if we build a patent system that's flexible enough that it can adapt to the needs of these new industries with their old, different characteristics, then we can have a system that is not in crisis, that's not subject to abuse, but serves the purposes that it's supposed to serve.
I think that I could not come up with a better cliffhanger in not only thanking you, Professor Mark Lindley from Stanford Law School, for joining us in Hearsay Culture, but inviting you back closer to the publication date to discuss that book. So thank you very much for being here, Mark. Greatly appreciate it. You've been listening to Hearsay Culture, and in fact, the show today discussing a wide variety of topics with respect to patent law with Professor Mark Lindley of Stanford Law School. There are a number of guests coming up where we're going to be exploring some of these issues. Among them are Professor Tim Holbrook, Holbrook from Chicago, Kent, who is also a patent law scholar. I'm looking forward to talking to Professor Jonathan Zittrain, an author of the book The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, as well as Danny Bretznitz, who has a fascinating book looking at innovation policies in different countries, and several other guests, Alex Wright, the author of Glut, Ned Snow, who's an intellectual property law scholar, as well as cyber law scholar, University of Arkansas, Little Rock. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture. As always, I look for your feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. You can find all of the previous shows and schedules at hearsayculture.com, and you can get the shows as well there, plus through iTunes and through the Stanford CIS website at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thank you for listening today, and I look forward to talking to you next week. Take care.